Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Bioform Connect podcast. So, in this podcast, we're joined by Dr. Suman Das from Takeda, who is a biocompatibility expert. In this podcast, we're delving into the critical aspects of drug device co-development, emphasizing the importance of early collaboration between teams to enhance patient safety and streamline processes. We also link this with biocompatibility, and we also touch on platform approaches for biocompatibility as well. Hope you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome everyone to another Bioforum podcast. Today we have a special guest with us in the form of Dr. Suman Das, and he's here from Takeda, which is where he currently resides. And we're going to be talking a little bit about drug device co-development with a biocompatibility spin on it. Suman is a member of our drug delivery forum and is thought leader, subject matter expert in biocompatibility. It's a collaboration work stream that I'm involved in as well. So I'm really looking forward to this podcast. I'm going to hand over to Suman to give an introduction on himself and tell you a bit more about him. Suman.
Thank you, Suresh. Thank you for having me, first of all, in your podcast. About me, I working in device world for last 10 years, mainly in device biocompatibility and device development side. I work in pure medical device and in form of combination device.
Great.
I'll keep it minimum and simple.
I know. So I've seen your full bio and it is very impressive. So we might put a link to that just so they can see all of your accolades and achievements throughout the years. Suman, can I put you on the spot and say, can you give an interesting fact about yourself as well?
My interesting fact about is I love traveling. And recently I came back from Italy after 10 days vacation. I love the place and the food, and especially the gelato.
Here, here, I can definitely agree with you there as an ice cream fanatic. So we have a tradition, Simon, in our house where whenever we go on holiday anywhere, I have to have a photo with ice cream in it. So everywhere I go, there's a photo of me with ice cream, and that has now spread to our children as well. So they always want ice cream, and we have photos of us all with ice cream. So
I know that part of you. You have sold that you ice cream and you in a presentation. So that's why I added the gelato. But we
I
really
like
love
it.
gelato.
Oh,
So yeah.
especially from Italy. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's brilliant. Thank you, Suman. Sorry for putting you on the spot, but it's always the best way to get a good response. So, Suman, we were here obviously to talk about drug device co-development. It's something that within the drug delivery forum we've been focusing in on. We know, just to set the background, is that when this forum first started, one of the key topics that was brought up was the challenges around drug device co-development, and it's still a topic that is talked about in conferences, presentations, and when you speak to the device development teams, it's something that I hear. So we made a decision and said, let's get this on the map. Let's talk to industry. Let's collate these challenges and let's share them with the industry via the medium of Bioforum. And that's what, this is the journey that we've started. And we want to talk to thought leaders from specific areas of device development, obviously in this case biocompatibility, to again try and understand those specific nuances, challenges that relate to those functions within device development, like biocompatibility. And that's how we got there. So I'll start off, Suman, by just talking. I'll just throw a few points at you, some of the key things that just keep getting repeated to me, and it'll be good to get your take on it. One is that the device team is an afterthought in drug device co-development. And other things I hear is it's just packaging, right? That's another one I hear all the time. And what I hear from other people is that they all struggle in the same way. So one example is that, you know, the feedback is, you know, why there's so many people in the devices team. But what they don't realize is that they're covering the full spectrum of that device development. Whereas in formulation, you've got different teams for different parts of that formulation development, you know, from discovery into phase three. So what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you are right. I think the pharmaceutical company also it depends on how long they're into combination. Think about this way that is evolved from a primary packaging vial and syringe configuration to a prefilled syringe to auto-injector, and that in last few years. It's not we have a like years of experience on pharmaceutical company to develop this. So that's where this confusion come in. And different company, there are some company get into this combination device long enough to they have experience, they have put together these development phases and how to connect and correlate. And also there are company who are very young and getting into device compared to you have a vial and syringe configuration. Think about whenever a young company starting to bring something to the market, their first target is bringing the drug to the market, and shortest path is the vial and syringe configuration.
Yes.
And then when you get experienced, you have some leverage, like, okay, how we can make the patient life better, how we can make it patient-centric. Mm-hmm. And you are thinking about then, okay, let's put it in an auto-injector. So patient can do it at home, you can reduce the cost of the healthcare, and also you can make it easier for patient rather than they have to go to the hospital for injection for the need, right? So that's why we need to understand these. We started this journey a few years ago. Some of the companies just also getting into, they have only one product, right? Sometimes they did this product development with outside vendor. Now they are slowly trying to bring it in-house. So there is always a learning phase.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. For Takeda, is also, if you look into the history of Takeda and how long they have devices, it's not many years. So though Takeda has some experience, there are other companies which I can name that they just going into device world, right? Mm-hmm. So that learning phase, like pharmaceutical, when you are talking about main focus and again drug, right? These all the pharmaceutical company, they will not make the device ever, right? Yeah. They mainly tell that our main focus on drug, but we want to make it easier for patients. We want to think about the cost of the healthcare. That's why we are trying to combine this in drug and device together. So in that way, your focus is drug. And when you are thinking about delivery, you are thinking about, oh, we just need to deliver it. And we have so many different delivery vehicles, and they are in the market. And that's why sometimes it seems to me that it being assumed that is not a difficult path. However, the challenges come in because regulatory constraint and the total development is not one particular aspect. There are so many moving things, and they all has to synchronize and go together so you can condense this development within a few years.
Yes, yeah. And one thing that you touched on, Simon, that was really interesting is that I feel like the patients, that their experience is going to be with the device. You know, and why is it going into an auto injector? Because obviously it's shown to improve adherence. It's more, as you've said, patient centric. It's And really that experience that they have with the device, and it's so important because that's what they'll remember really. And as someone said, is that the drug is only as good as the device that's used to deliver it. And, you know, if your device development ends up being on a critical path, or you're using the drug with a subpar device because you want to hit those timelines, how does that impact on the patient? You know, because ultimately it's that patient experience that suffers, and it's that risk again. And, you know, that's something that around, you know, trying to highlight, I guess, the importance of the device and how important it is and how it needs to be given sufficient time. The device development needs to be given sufficient time, and it needs to be a high level of understanding at, you know, at that high level, at that senior leader exec level, of the timelines and the factors that could influence and impact on the device development. So that's what I took as well from, you know, from the conversations that I've had, and the importance of the device. And we know how important it is, but it's just getting everyone else on board.
Yes, that crosstalk and early crosstalk is what needed. And I think companies are right now, is the organization wise, you need help in organization, right? And also you need some post, like a third party maybe, or someone who can oversee both together to do a seamless combination, right? It's still, it is two different departments, and they has to cross talk and how, what point you might need something in organization which can make this more coherent, right?
And they need to speak two languages, right, Suman? They need to understand devices, they need to understand formulation, they need to, and they need to understand the impacts that decisions will have on both sides of things, because they're both important.
Yes. And regulation-wise, think about when formulation-wise, I'm thinking about this is a primary packaging. I'm looking into only USP, and if they have done this, companies done this USP guidelines for years, they have experience. And when this device come in, there is also a gray area, USP versus ISO. And sometime you get into those discussion, and those discussions sometime is long and deep, that what we should follow, how we should follow it to make sure we coherent to both USP and ISO. Because it depends on, at least in USA for FDA, based on it, mode of action, COA, right? Yeah. Which part of the FDA is reviewing your combination product? If your mode of action is for is the device is the main thing, then CDRH will look into it. If it's your drug is your mode of action, then CDAR or CIVAL will look into it, right? So that's also changes the focus on, like, who is reviewing it, where you have the stress, and make sure ultimately you identified all the risk for patient and you mitigate it.
Yeah. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? You know, everything that we do is about the patient, and it's about mitigating the risk, understanding the risk. And that's where so many of our conversations have taken us previously. And the risk assessment, it's a risk-based approach, isn't it? At the end of the day, the work that we do.
And as you started that biocompatibility has been to it, ISO 10993 recent update in 2018 specifically talked about it's no more checklist, it's risk-based approach, right? There is a list of tests for us to make our life easier, what test you need to consider, but that's not all of it. You might have to consider some extra risk based on your device and the user need. Might be another device doesn't have those requirements, right? So understanding the risk of the device will be the key. And FDA always says that hey, I do not know about your device, everything. You have to, or any regulatory agencies, like you have to explain what did the user need, how you will be comply with that, and what are the risks coming from it. And if you can explain that, you can show that this is how this device operates, these are the risks identified, and these are the mitigation we have in place to make sure this is acceptable to the patient.
Yeah, absolutely. And Suma, can I ask on that piece then, if we kind of segue to the device development and biocompatibility, from your experience, what are the kind of main challenges that have come about for you from a biocompatibility perspective during, you know, drug device co-development? What have you looked back on and said, oh, we could have done that differently, or we should have done that differently? Why didn't we do it this way? Or why weren't we informed earlier of this? What? So yeah, just if you have any case studies or you wanted to share a challenge and how you think you could have done it better, I think that would be really great.
So first of all, we need to understand that device biocompatibility is critical for any device, right? Now, it comes to in my attention that, okay, oh, device biocompatibility is already easy because this device is already in the market, right? Or this is a platform technology, we already using it in different device. One thing coming to, at least in I try to convey the message, you need to look into when you are submitting something, then your device is up for current regulation and guidelines. If you have submitted something 5 years ago and there are some regulation and guidelines changed, that means you now coherent to the new guidelines.
Yes.
And that's where it's a big gap is that, okay, oh, we didn't thought about that and we didn't allocate that time, which is needed for doing those tests. Then you get into a spiral and biocompatibility become your critical path. And the problem that is these tests, some of these biocompatibility tests is long lead time and resource heavy. It's not like, oh, this is less than $5,000, so we don't have any go through any separate approval and all. No, some are $50,000 to $60,000 animal testing. And if you get into that position, now you have to change everything. Your timeline impact is huge. Your resource, you will over budget and all. So it is important to consider biocompatibility early, much early than in phase two. So think about it when you started late phase one. So stepping back, when you need biocompatibility? That's the question people ask, right? Mm-hmm. Answer is depends on. Right? It depends on what kind of device you are using. If you are doing a device which is a platform device, you already have used it in other product, your workload might be less. However, right now, based on your user need, you are using a device, it might be first time going into the market. Then those needs are different. You need to have much bigger and detailed risk analysis compared to something you can refer on. Oh, that product is in the market for 10 years. I'm not telling that you don't have to do the risk analysis. However, your burden is much less because you have some market data or failure data, you post-market data, you can support that your device is safe. Right. So I will think about, I always tell that as early as possible, when you are thinking about you want to go with a device, have a risk analysis for biocompatibility. Look into those, and then determine case by case when biocompatibility need to start.
Yes.
Right? One example, we know extractable leachable sometimes takes over a year to get all the result and toxicity analysis. And not giving this, sometime if you have an unknown and that's above AET, then you are kind of in a limbo to identify that. If it is below AET, okay, you don't have to consider that.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
for
yeah.
the worst case scenario, right? So
yeah.
So think about if you have already a device which is a platform technology, you don't have to worry about that. But if you are thinking about bringing something to the market, some innovative product, which is not glass, which is maybe some kind of plastic, right? Which have a more risk to leaching something. There your timeline is different and it's sometimes very hard to pinpoint.
Yes. Suman, I have so many questions. I don't even know where to start. I'll start with one, which is with platforms and biocompatibility. Would it not be sensible to take the approach of, okay, I'm going to do on this platform technology device, I'm going to do the full works on biocompatibility so that I can leverage as a worst case kind of scenario so that I can then leverage all of that data for any future uses of that device? Would that approach, does that happen or does it make sense?
That's actually, at least that's the idea for right now pharmaceutical company is operating, right? Based on that idea that if it's a platform technology, we have analyzed it enough, we have done biocompatibility tests, we have a safety record of it.
Yeah.
So in that way, we are much easier on explaining or mitigating the risk.
Yes.
However, one thing, sometimes I will tell you in my experience or how I spoke with colleagues in this area from different company, they have successful doing the test, not on final finished device. So what they did, they tried to make it at least easier by doing the full suite of testing on sterilized device, right? So think about if it is a biologics or small molecule, you take a sterilized device, syringe, and then you, in an aseptic condition, you do fill finish device and then you release it. Some cases for small molecule, you still can sterilize. However, for biologics, we know we cannot sterilize, so we go with aseptic condition. So your final finished device, if you have to wait for that batch to do a full suite of testing, you are pushing your timeline to close. So the strategy being successful that doing this test on the not in final finished device, just on the components. You do the testing on the component. At the end, you take a final finished device and do maybe a general testing to make sure it comply with your component level testing.
Right.
Like for name, like you do cytotoxicity, which is a general screening technique to make sure that it is safe, and then the other endpoints, right? So that might be an option if you are too close to your timeline or you want to push it to the market quicker. In that way, you still have showing that you have, first of all, we need to understand that the biocompatibility for combination device, which is syringe, what if we are thinking about devices like prefill syringe, auto injector, right? Though those are low risk devices.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? From biocompatibility point of view.
Yes.
And that's why maybe if you are in time constraint, then component level test and then verification with one general screening testing might be a good approach. However, the ideal condition, what regulatory is want to see, that your device go through the manufacturing process. Yeah. And you get the final finished device and do the full suite of testing. That would be ideal for any devices. But think about for platform technology, you don't want to repeat that testing for final finished device for each time you bring a product.
Of course. In those cases,
the component level testing and one screening testing each time, which is not very time consuming and not resource heavy, could be one of the pros to consider. However, I always talk about this, that if there is an opportunity to talk to FDA, to type B, type C meeting, or for CDRH, the other mechanism, QSUB, right?
Yes, yeah.
Have those already laid out with regulatory body and reviewer. Have a discussion. And they are pretty open what they're going to be accepting, what not.
You don't
want to have the surprise for the last minute that we are pretty confident this worked last time and this gonna work again. And that's where I was like, okay, wait. I know there is a precedent, but think about this. Reviewer, you are not getting maybe the same reviewer.
Yes.
What are your chances to get the same reviewer? You exactly. might be getting a different reviewer, and he or she has a totally different perspective.
Exactly. And Suman, with the reviewers, what if that kind of biocompatibility knowledge is a complete missing gap? What do they do in those? So you have a meeting with them, you know, a pre-meeting, you're talking to them, want to ask some questions about your approach and what would be acceptable, like the one you outlined. But once if they don't have that biocompatibility knowledge, what's the you know, what do they just have a consultant come in?
That's a very good question. I have faced that. From the you pose a question and you see the answer, and sometimes you see the answer is so simple in the depth, what you looking yeah. for is not there and missing.
Yeah.
And that could be two different reasons. One, they wanted to keep it vague because these communication earlier, like QSUB, type B, type C meeting, is non-binding.
Yes.
Right, so they gave you a comment doesn't mean that during the final review they will not come and change their position. That's yeah. possible, but still yeah. I will think about this. Different reviewer has different depth, right? Different yeah. understanding of biocompatibility. Not only that, who is reviewing it, which agency is reviewing it, make a difference. Like think yeah. about if, and I think from one of my discussion with FDA is something, if it goes to CBER or CDER, I my most experience again on FDA. So Suresh, I yeah. will talk about FDA.
That's fine.
And for like EMA, my experience is different. It's very straightforward. Right, I felt like EMA is they have group who is expert in biocompatibility and they look into yes. specific yeah. section. Whereas in FDA, if there is a different agencies, there maybe you will see that there are is reviewer dependent ultimately, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you might see that. Sometime you get away with minimum, sometime asking more. But I always at least suggest in my colleague and in my team that look for standard. Don't look for what yeah. I could get away with or what precedent is. That's not your boundary or the level you want to set. You want to set a bar which is compliant with the standard, and you mitigated all the risk, right? You don't have to do all the tests, but do consider all the risk. And then justify why you think that risk is not applicable for this device.
Absolutely. And you know, so we've talked about setting the bar and the bar of expectation with regulators and how it can go both ways, where it's, you know, it's within my nature to go above and beyond, you know, to say I want to go above and beyond because I don't want to be the person that impacts the timelines. I want to make sure my bit is done and I'm not responsible for any delays in a project. But in that same instance, by going above and beyond with your testing, you could be artificially setting the bar of what the expectation is without you even knowing it. And then when that regulator goes to company B or C, they'll be like, you know, we saw, and maybe they don't have as much experience in that part, but then they've set that bar in their head of that's what I want to see because that was really good. And that's what we've been talking about, isn't it? About how we need to understand what the acceptable level of testing is based on the standard that is not creating an artificial bar within the industry that is just being set that everyone else ends up having to adhere to. And I think that's such an important point, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Totally, I agree with that because you want to adhere and comply with the standard, but you doesn't have to be so risk adverse that you do all the tests, right? Mm-hmm. In that way, and regulatory body will not come back and say that, okay, you have done more testing. You have done okay, good, low risk, but I definitely think about there are devices where your risk is high, where you need to do the test. There are devices which doesn't have that much risk. So having that thorough, again, I think I mentioned it a couple of times over this podcast that looking into the risk of the device, do a thorough risk analysis to identify in the earlier phase that what are the risks for this device and what tests we need to do. And one thing I will mention here that regulatory agencies, at least for FDA, if it is a biocompatibility is a user need, right? That your device need to be safe for the patient. In that way, you need to have a plan and you need to have a report. And sometimes I see that summary are being produced and submitted and they have success with it. However, I will suggest to it, not that you have to do the plan. However, having that plan early in the phase two will give you guideline and reduce your risk on your timeline and resource in the later stage because you already know your plan. You know that, okay, I have a biocompatibility SME expert looked into my device and the drug interaction, and this is the plan we need to incorporate in my program planning for the development stage. In that way, you can reduce that risk because you need biocompatibility test whenever your device coming in contact to the patient. It's not for the final market release. So for your clinical trial, you also need your biocompatibility done.
Mm. Suman, if I could ask one more question to you around this biocompatibility and drug device co-development. When would be, if I had to twist your arm, when would be the ideal time for the biocompatibility team to be engaged in the drug device development process? Because I guess we've talked about typically phase two. Traditionally, phase two is where, you know, everything comes to a head and, you know, that we need to select the device. But is there benefit in being involved earlier in the process, and how early would that be?
Think about there is come that platform technology. It doesn't have to be with a drug development program. It could be a separate program where you can evaluate a couple of devices, do the testing, and you have for different configuration, you have component level testing. Yeah. And that is outside and not connected to a particular drug device developer.
Yes.
So think about you have a 1 ml configuration, you have a 2 ml configuration, you have a dual chamber cartridge, so different configuration, you do all the testing, you have everything ready now.
Yeah.
And when you are thinking about, okay, my need for this particular drug and user need will develop later when your drug development, you are going through the phases, then you can think about which one I should select.
Mm-hmm.
And you already know that that one, I have our biocompatibility testing.
Yeah.
We already done it. So, okay, this is what we go with because we know. And at that time, when you are selecting, do a planning, what level of testing you need. But it, yes, I believe, or at least advocate for, do your biocompatibility testing outside your program also. In
yes.
that way, it's decoupled. You have all the testing.
Yes.
When you need, you just bring it in, and that can streamline your development.
Exactly. And then you could even do your gap analysis as well, see if there's anything that isn't that you don't have that you would need as well, and what those timelines would look like.
And also the when, which year, and which guideline is actually the previous testing done for, and is there any change in the next testing?
Yes, absolutely. Suman, thank you so much for joining us today. The time has flown with this podcast. I think I could talk to you for another half an hour easily and just pick your brain. But if I could just ask one last thing to leave us with in terms of how do you see the industry changing in terms of on this drug device co-development? Since you've been involved in biopharma, have you seen a shift for more inclusion of the device team? Is that an industry shift that's changing and you can see it changing where the device teams are being brought in earlier and being considered earlier? Is that something that you can see? And generally, what is your thought on that?
I think I can tell you that last few conferences I attended, one common buzzword is crosstalk between drug and device team and how early they could involve will help them.
Yes.
And that's, I think, that is very vocal. Device team and drug both are very vocal because they are seeing the advantages being involved early, right?
Yes.
So I think there is a change. However, it will need some time to fall into place, right?
Yeah.
Everything when it's become a common culture that, okay, yes, we need to get involved. We need to involve them, get actually opinion as early as possible. So I think industry is moving that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
However, there may be some time needed for those companies which are young in drug and device to have that culture established.
Yes. And that's what we're doing, Suman, isn't it? We're with everything that we do, we're building awareness. And with the work that we're doing within drug delivery, of trying to build awareness of the challenges. So hopefully in some way we can accelerate that for the industry and support all of our device teams that are finding themselves on the critical path on a regular basis where they shouldn't be.
Yeah, we definitely, I think BioForum has done a really good job on influencing and like thinking people on that direction and having more open discussion. And whenever you agree to it and have an open discussion, you see this advantage.
Yes. And Simon, thank you so much for your openness today and in general within our collaborations. And thank you so much again for being part of this podcast. And I hope that you can come on again so we can explore maybe sustainability and other interesting topics as well that we can certainly talk about. But
yes, sustainability is my next topic of interest. I recently completed my EMBA and I did a project, the capstone project on sustainability, which was a lot of learning, and I loved that area.
Amazing.
Where I was not involved earlier that much. Anyway, hey, thank you for having me. It was always my pleasure to talk to you. Okay.
Thank you, Simon. Likewise.
Yes.
Take care. And you'll be on back. You'll be back again soon, and we'll talk about sustainability.
Sure.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, Suresh.
A big thank you to Dr. Simon Daz for joining us for this podcast session, and I hope you'll join us for the next installment. Thank you.